Well, welcome to iFormRx, where we explore the evidence that matters to ambulatory care pharmacy practice. My name is Stuart Haynes, Editor-in-Chief of iFormRx, and today we're going to be talking about asthma action plans and how to abort exacerbations. We all know that patients with persistent asthma should be on an inhaled steroid to control their asthma symptoms, as well as a short-acting beta agonist for quick relief of shortness of breath. Any patient who's had a severe exacerbation requiring an unplanned acute care visit really should have an action plan as well. Typically, an asthma action plan recommends that patients temporarily increase the use of their rescue inhaler if their symptoms worsen into the yellow zone, and if the symptoms continue to worsen, to take a systemic steroid like an oral prednisone or prednisolone. But why couldn't patients just increase the dose of their inhaled steroid? Well, that's what two studies published in the New England Journal of Medicine in March 2018 explored. They quadrupled and quintupled the dose of the inhaled steroid. But did it work? Well, here to tell us about the results of those two studies and whether increasing the dose of inhaled steroids at the first sign of an asthma exacerbation is a good idea is Dr. Kristen Pate. And Dr. Pate is one of my colleagues here at the University of Mississippi School of Pharmacy, and she practices at Internal Medicine Associates in Oxford, Mississippi. So, Kristen, it's great to have you on the iFormRx podcast.
Thank you, Stuart. It's great to be here.
So, Kristen, before we get started, I want you to imagine you're seeing NB, a 15-year-old Latino male, in the family medicine clinic today. And the patient has been referred to you for asthma education. He's accompanied by his mother. NB is believed to have had asthma since he was around 8 or 9 years old, but didn't really get treatment or the official diagnosis until about 3 years ago. He has moderate persistent asthma and has been prescribed fluticasone, the Flovent discus inhaler, 250 micrograms twice daily, and albuterol as a rescue inhaler. 2 weeks ago, the patient ended up in the emergency department due to shortness of breath, and this episode really frightened the patient as well as his mother. The patient admits he wasn't doing a very good job about using his controller medication every day, and the primary care physician increased the dose of fluticasone from 100 micrograms twice daily to 250 micrograms twice daily a few days ago and referred the patient to you to create an asthma action plan. So before we talk about the two recently published studies, which you examined in your commentary about high-dose inhaled steroids to abort asthma exacerbations, I'm wondering what's going through your mind in a case like this. What additional information would you like to gather during this encounter? And what additional treatment options would you be thinking about at this point? And what would you be including in his asthma action plan?
Well, in light of the two new studies that we'll be talking about today, I'm at least wondering, could we have prevented NB's emergency department visit? In reality, I think that his visit was multifactorial. I mean, one, for moderate persistent asthma in a 15-year-old patient, generally guidelines would recommend that he would already be on either combination therapy with the low-dose inhaled corticosteroid plus a long-acting beta agonist or a medium-dose inhaled corticosteroid. So at his 100 micrograms twice daily dose, which that's what he was being treated at when he went to the emergency room, he really wasn't at the optimal dosage range that would be recommended by the guidelines when he had this exacerbation. But honestly, it seems that based on your comment that he wasn't always good and doing a good job about using his controller medication twice daily, I assume that adherence also should be a concern of ours. And along those same lines, when he did use his inhaler, was he even using it correctly? And had he ever received self-management education? So I would really want to know more about what his triggers are, if he's making efforts to avoid them, is he using the inhaler appropriately? So that's a lot of the additional information that I would like to have before making the asthma action plan.
So, Kristen, the commentary you wrote for iFormerX entitled, Is It Time to Step Up Our Rescue Treatment to Prevent Asthma Exacerbations? You described two studies published on the same day in the same issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. The first study is entitled, Quadrupling Inhaled Glucocorticoids to Abort Asthma Exacerbations. And the second study is entitled, Quintupling Inhaled Corticosteroids to Prevent Childhood Asthma Exacerbations. Now, for the benefit of our audience and for those who haven't read those papers yet, can you give us a brief synopsis of the study methods and results?
Sure. As you mentioned, both studies evaluated the idea of increasing the inhaled corticosteroid or ICS dose by 4 or 5 times the maintenance dose when patients have symptoms consistent with the yellow zone, ideally to help prevent the asthma exacerbation from ever occurring. The first study was a pragmatic, unblinded, randomized trial that included 1,922 adult and adolescent patients with asthma at least 16 years old, receiving an inhaled glucocorticoid, and having had at least one asthma exacerbation that required systemic glucocorticoids in the past year. Patients were randomized to one of two self-management plan groups. We'll call one the quadrupling ICS dose group and the other the non-quadrupling ICS dose group. The self-management plans for each group were based on asthma UK guidelines, and they only differed in what the patients were instructed to do in zone two. Essentially, this is the same as the yellow zone. When the patients first had symptoms consistent with the yellow zone, the patients in the quadrupling group were instructed to increase their bronchodilator medication for symptom relief, as well as to increase their ICS by a factor of 4. The patients in the non-quadrupling group were only instructed to increase their bronchodilator medication. The participants were followed for 12 months, and the primary outcome was the time to a severe asthma exacerbation. A secondary outcome was the number of participants that had the severe exacerbation. It ended up that 45% of patients in the quadrupling group and 52% of patients in the non-quadrupling group reported a severe asthma exacerbation, with an adjusted hazard ratio for the time to first exacerbation of 0.81. Adverse events were reported for 2 to 4 weeks after the zone 2 or yellow zone activation. Hospitalization was one of the serious adverse events reported, but it was also included in the primary outcome analysis, and it was the most reported serious adverse event. There wasn't a significant difference in the incidence of pneumonia between the groups, and as one might expect, the non-serious adverse events related to the local effects of the inhaled glucocorticoids were higher in the quadrupling group. The second study, on the other hand, was a 52-week randomized, double-blind, parallel group trial that included 254 children with asthma age 5 to 11 that had at least one asthma exacerbation treated with systemic glucocorticoids in the previous year. The participants were randomized in a 1-to-1 ratio to receive blinded inhaled glucocorticoid therapy either at the low dose or at the high dose, which was considered quintupling their low-dose therapy. They did this for 7 days after they had early signs of reduced asthma control or when they were in the yellow zone. All participants received the open-label low-dose ICS maintenance therapy when they were in the green zone, and they discontinued this treatment when they were receiving the blinded yellow zone therapy. The primary outcome for this study was the rate of severe asthma exacerbations treated with systemic glucocorticoids. There were 38 participants in the high-dose group and 30 in the low-dose group that had at least one severe asthma exacerbation treated with systemic glucocorticoids. The rate in the high-dose group was 0.48 exacerbations per year, and the rate in the low-dose group was 0.37 per year. Children in the high-dose group also did have greater exposure to glucocorticoids than children in the low-dose group. The growth rate in the high-dose group was 0.23 centimeters less per year compared to the low-dose group. The investigators did conclude that quintupling the dose of inhaled glucocorticoids for 7 days at the first sign of loss of asthma control did not reduce the rate of severe exacerbations requiring systemic glucocorticoid treatment and did not improve other asthma outcomes. But it did result in greater exposure to glucocorticoids and a reduced linear growth rate.
So, Kristen, tell us a little bit about what you think are some of the key strengths and limitations of these studies, and are there any major sources of bias or confounders that threaten the internal validity of these studies?
For the first trial, including adults and adolescents, when the trial was designed, the investigators felt that a 30% or greater reduction in exacerbations would be clinically meaningful. So, while the 19% reduction found was statistically significant, one could question the true clinical impact. But nonetheless, the number needed to treat in order to prevent one additional exacerbation was 15. The strengths of this study also include increased external validity due to its pragmatic design, with 80% of participants recruited from primary care, and it had a really broad inclusion criteria. However, can't help but mention that the unblinded nature of the study definitely increases the risk of bias and could have influenced patients' decisions to seek medical care or the physician's treatment decisions. The second trial was a randomized, double-blind, parallel group trial, giving it a little more internal validity probably compared to the pragmatic design of the other study, which had more external validity. But it should be noted that fewer yellow zone episodes and severe exacerbations than they anticipated were observed, thus reducing the power of the trial to really detect a difference between the groups. However, the data didn't really suggest that the high-dose group was likely to derive any benefits, and the authors concluded that enrolling more patients to meet power probably wouldn't have changed the study's conclusions. Also, the results of this study are limited to a very specific patient group, children age 5 to 11 with mild to moderate persistent asthma on low-dose ICS maintenance therapy.
So, back to our case. Based on the results of these two studies, do you think they should influence practice? Should we be including high-dose inhaled steroids in our asthma action plans from now on? And would you recommend it in a case like NB's?
Well, Stuart, obviously the results of these studies conflict each other and makes it really kind of tough for me. But also, they're two very different studies as far as trial design go, and they're in very different patient groups. So for me, in children, that study definitely doesn't give me any reason to change practice at this point. And there's more risk in children with increased glucocorticoid use and exposure. For adults, on the other hand, when I first read the study, I was thinking it might be worth a try. If this can possibly prevent exacerbations and it doesn't have terrible adverse events in the adult population. But on the flip side, I also can't help but think that we might need a little more evidence before this is common practice. This trial definitely had some limitations, and we can't exactly rule out the fact that both the patient and the provider behavior could have been impacted by the unblinded nature of the trial. I do still think that a huge factor in preventing exacerbations is patient education and patient self-management, and we can't forget that. So we know that regardless of what your maintenance treatment is and what your asthma action plan includes, it's so important that the patients understand what each medication is for, and how and when it should be used.
So, Kristen, it's been a pleasure to have you on the iFormerX podcast today, and I want to thank you for joining me to discuss the treatment of asthma and the use of action plans to manage asthma exacerbations. And I think it's clear from your comments that perhaps quadrupling or quintupling inhaled steroids is not exactly ready for prime time, and that we really need to focus on patient education and making sure that patients are on the appropriate guideline recommended treatments and that they're using them appropriately. But tell us what you think. Only iFormerX members can leave comments and use the interactive features on the site. You can become a member of iFormerX. It's free, so sign up today and be sure to sign in every time you visit. And until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormerX, signing off.